Hello, this is The New World, a podcast produced by Reaction, exploring the world after the coronavirus crisis. I'm Jack Dickens, international editor at Reaction. The European Union is at a crossroads. The Eurozone, grappling with the fallout from the global financial crisis, has now been hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. And on the geopolitical stage too, European leaders have struggled to find a coherent response to a resurgent Russia and the rise of a more assertive China. Does this present a terminal threat, or will a stronger Europe emerge in the coming years? With me to discuss the future of Europe today are Helen Thompson, Professor of Political Economy at the University of Cambridge, and Matthew Karnichnik, Chief Europe Correspondent at Politico. I'd like to start, Helen, by asking you, how well is the European Union handling the coronavirus crisis?
Well, I think that that's actually multiple questions, and then that says something actually quite important about the European Union. So if we say, like, how is it handling the health crisis? Well, the bottom line there is that it isn't its job to handle the health crisis. It doesn't have the authority, the competence, the policy competence, you know, in order to do that. That belongs to the national governments. If we then say, how is it handling the economic crisis? I think that we have to break that down into separate questions as well. How are the Eurozone states, how is the Eurozone handling the crisis? How then are the individual EU members that are not in the Eurozone doing with the economic situation? And then how is the EU as a unified single market and all that goes with that handling the crisis? I would then say there's a kind of third level to it as to how is the EU doing with the geopolitical crisis that's been brought about by the total implosion really of the US-China relationship. So if we take the economic ones first, I'd say is that the Eurozone states are doing what they usually do in crisis, which is just about muddle through. There's going to be hard decisions to be taken over the next few days, which I'm sure we're going to go on to talk about. But I don't think that anything disastrous has happened for the Eurozone in what we've seen so far. But at the same time, we've seen once again how difficult the questions that the Eurozone structures throw up are to resolve. I would say on the single market question that actually the EU has struggled, and that what we've seen through this I think is a new and significant development is that the single market, because some of its rules, not least around state aid, have had to be suspended, has really become quite politicized during the crisis, and that is going to continue, particularly because Germany is the state that is most able to benefit from the suspension of state aid rules. And then on the geopolitics, on the US-China breakdown, I'd say that the EU hasn't been doing very well. I would say that's quite predictable because generally the EU doesn't do very well with geopolitical questions.
Thank you, Helen. I think what you're clearly raising is that this crisis has thrown into sharp relief the complex interrelations which really constitute the European Union. And there's perhaps a sense in which this rules-based order doesn't necessarily deal very well with shocks which come from outside and are unanticipated. Matthew, do you have anything to add after what Helen has just said there?
Well, I would also say that the rules-based order, as you call it, whenever it's challenged, it hasn't really worked particularly well. You know, the wheels quickly come off. And we saw this with Schengen in this crisis, for example, where, you know, within a couple of days, it seemed, all of a sudden, you know, the borders went back up in Europe. And as Helen pointed to, the single market came under pretty severe strain. And you sort of see the reality of the Eurozone and the EU in the midst of this crisis, which is that Germany is really more powerful and significant within this structure than people really like to admit. And that perhaps in the long term could be a problem. But it could also be the solution in getting through this, I would argue, as we've seen over the last several weeks in terms of the discussions around recovery fund and related issues to that. But I think a lot of people in sort of establishment circles in European capitals were quite surprised at just how quickly, you know, things that they took for granted about Europe, you know, started to look very shaky in the middle of this crisis. And I don't know that there's an easy solution to that. And I think this is something that, you know, people in Europe are going to be thinking a lot about in the coming weeks and months about how to deal with this fragility.
So you raised the question of coronavirus relief, and this has turned into one of the great political and live questions in Europe at the moment. It's still ongoing. Aside from whether these plans will succeed or not, or what form they will succeed in, are they likely to be enough for Europe's struggling states such as Italy and Spain after the crisis?
Well, I think as Helen said, the Eurozone always manages to muddle through events like this. And it does seem that the recovery fund is going to be another muddle. Unfortunately, there's all of this focus now on this question of whether they will succeed in the coming days in agreeing on a recovery fund and what structure it will have, how much will be grants and how much will be loans and so forth. There's not enough focus maybe on the question that you've asked, is this going to be enough? And most of the economists that I speak to doubt that it will be in the long term. If you look particularly at Italy and the challenges that it's going to be facing in the coming months and probably years, a recovery fund, which for the entire EU totals 500 billion, is probably not going to do it, given the fiscal constraints that Italy itself faces. If you compare that, say, to Germany again, where the German parliament has already passed aid and support totaling over a trillion euros just for Germany, you can see sort of the divide here. So I think this is part of the problem, is that there's too much focus on the very near term and getting this recovery fund in place. It's symbolically important, perhaps, but is it really going to do the job? And I have my doubts there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the recovery fund is much more symbolically significant than it is actually practically significant. And I think that it's illustration of one of the difficulties that the Eurozone faces is that it's trying to deal with its own fiscal structures in an overriding structure with this recovery fund that is actually focused around the EU as a whole and not the Eurozone. So, for instance, the question of this recovery fund is going to get tangled up with the question of rule and law issues in Hungary. That's very clear. But in terms of Italy's prospects, it seems to me that the European Central Bank's pandemic purchase program is of much more significance, actually, than this recovery fund, that Italy needs to be able to borrow more. And it's got a better chance, so far as the ECB manages to keep that spread with rates with Germany absolutely as low as possible. Now, would Italy benefit from there being a much bigger recovery fund? Of course it would. But anything that would actually make a difference to Italy, as Matthew's saying, is not on the table. So how things work out with the ECB and whether Italy can benefit from the European Stability Mechanism funds without any prospect of significant political conditionality being attached to that, and whether that's palatable in Italian politics, because the Italian government is very divided about that question. That seems to me actually, in terms of load-bearing material consequences, more significant than the recovery fund. But the recovery fund matters because it says it's telling us something about the internal politics, not just of the Eurozone, but the way that that interacts with the internal politics of the EU as a whole.
I'm glad you raised the question of, you know, symbolism and structure and what is more important, because is there a sense that fundamentally, when it comes down to this, these are not technocratic decisions, these are political decisions. And what we're seeing to a certain extent is a contest over what the future of Europe should look like. That answer will be different in the German Constitutional Court than it will be in the ECB, and it will be different in Southern Europe than it will be in Holland. Is this the key problem we're facing now? Is it about ideas rather than about the structures in place necessarily, or are the two related?
Well, I think they are very related. And on this question, for example, of the role of the ECB, it's also it's a very political question at the end of the day, not just in Germany, I think across the Eurozone. And the interesting thing to me about this recovery fund debate is that it started really as a way to, you know, get away from relying on the ECB to the degree that the Eurozone has, or the troubled Eurozone countries have in recent years. And in the wake of this ruling by the German Constitutional Court, which really, I think, was kind of a warning sign to Berlin and to other governments in Europe that, you know, this can't continue, that the German court is not going to continue to allow the ECB to kind of, you know, print money forever. So, you know, that turned it into a very political moment, I would say. And I'm not sure that Angela Merkel would have been as willing to cross this Rubicon, you know, with France in agreeing to a recovery fund of this size, whether it's large enough or not. You know, it is a very important principle that she's embracing here, if it hadn't been for that court ruling. I don't think that this has been settled, however. And I think this is the problem again. And here you get back to the muddle. They sort of take half steps in a direction. And maybe, you know, this is what will be required. I mean, if you look sort of at the past decade, I would say, you know, you see this repeatedly during the Greek crisis, the way that they set up structures outside of the treaty, you know, to have the bailout fund, you know, and eventually created a structure within the EU, but with very strict conditionality, the ESM, as it's called, the European Stability Mechanism. And then, you know, they managed to sell that in particular to the frugals, as they're now called, by insisting that there would be very strict conditionality. And what happened in the midst of this crisis, the first thing they did was they threw that conditionality out the window and said, well, Italy, you can take these loans basically without any conditions, more or less, which would have been unthinkable a year ago. So you see there is a certain degree of flexibility here when you're in the throes of a crisis like this. And that's really where the politics come in. So I think if you are sort of an optimist about Europe, you know, you have to conclude that when push comes to shove, they'll always find a way to kind of, you know, keep things moving along. It might not be the ideal solution in most cases, but it does keep, you know, the band playing, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the question on the Eurozone is actually that the structural problem and the disagreement problem, the different views, have been embedded together from the start. So if you go back to the Maastricht Treaty, you have a very clear separation between monetary policy, which is going to be set by the European Central Bank, and in that sense is a union federal matter. I mean, leaving aside for the moment the fact that not everybody in the EU was joining the Eurozone. And then the rest of economic policy, but in particular, or particularly consequentially, fiscal policy was for the member states. And indeed, in the Maastricht Treaty originally, there wasn't even the Stability and Growth Pact that then, you know, set fiscal rules for the member states. It was going to be entirely member states' discretion about what that they did with fiscal policy. And that structure has proved not to work. And lots of the things that have happened since have been trying to deal with the fact that it doesn't work and trying to, at least since 2010, since the Greek crisis really took the shape that it did, to improvise around that, including the European Central Bank becoming a lender of last resort to support the borrowing of member states without changing the treaty, without having a new treaty, because it's too politically difficult to have a new treaty. And that is really, I think, why we've ended up with the position where we have with the German Constitutional Court. The German Constitutional Court is really, I think, calling out the fact, ultimately, that all these changes have been made that actually aren't authorised by the treaties themselves. But if you go back and say, well, why was monetary union set up in the way in which it was in the Maastricht Treaty that drew this really sharp distinction between monetary policy and everything else? The answer is because there was a particular German at the time way of thinking about these questions, about the relationship between monetary policy and everything else, that won out. And that not everybody, not least the French, who signed the Maastricht Treaty, had the same view about monetary policy and the fact that it should have as its be-all and end-all price stability. And then you can add into that the fact that actually we've moved into a broader economic world where trying to keep inflation as low as possible doesn't seem as important, even to some extent, I think, in Germany, as it did in the late 80s, early 1990s, when monetary union was being conceived. So you simultaneously have structures that reflected disagreement, where the argument was won by one particular state, Germany, that were conceived in economic times that actually don't exist any longer. And the disagreement was never resolved. So it's not like everybody else, in particular the French, came round to the German way of thinking about these things. Disagreement persisted and was managed. And now the consequences of it are being played out in a very different economic context than the one in which it arose.
So these issues really do run deep into European history, and I'd like to turn now perhaps to another one which also runs deep into the past, and that is the question of the Visegrad states in Eastern Central Europe. Over the last decade, we've seen a more authoritarian and more illiberal model of government arise in Poland under the Law and Justice Party and in Hungary under Viktor Orban. Do you think we've reached the point now at which this style of government is a real threat to the rules-based order of the EU? Or, as you've been saying, do you think the EU will find a way to keep muddling through with this?
I want to be consistent here, so I'll say that they will keep muddling through on this front as well. The question that always comes up, you know, when Europe faces a crisis, which you know is quite frequently, is what is the alternative? And almost always the alternative is the destruction of the EU or some sort of steps that would lead to its dissolution, perhaps, is always worse than the status quo. And I think this is also true with Poland and Hungary. And here again, I don't think that you can really look at the situation in the Visegrad countries without thinking about the role that Germany plays there, in this case, particularly economically. And if you look at how intertwined those economies are with the German economy, particularly the car industry in Hungary and in Poland, or even Slovakia and the Czech Republic. You know, German industry has sort of turned that region into its machine room floor in a lot of ways. And this is why I think that the Germans in particular are trying to keep things on an even keel to the degree that they can. So I don't see, the situation in Poland, which, has now obviously been confirmed again that we're not going to see big changes in Poland anytime soon following the re-election of President Duda. I think that the Germans in particular are going to find ways to work around that, because it's too important to them to keep these countries in the EU, in the common market. And for those countries themselves, they have no interest in leaving the EU either at the end of the day. So I think there's just going to, be this situation where nobody likes what's happening there. Well, nobody in sort of the Western European context is very happy about it, but they've sort of learned to live with it. And I suspect that will continue.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I would say that, well, the one thing I would add is I think that what we're going to see over the recovery fund, which I think I mentioned earlier, is that these issues are going to get muddled up with that. And they are going to get more muddled up with the Eurozone governance issues than I think that they have hitherto been. And I think that this is actually the consequence of the road that Merkel and Macron decided to go down with their proposal for the recovery fund that was going to run through the EU budget. Because once you dealt with what was essentially a Eurozone governance issue, although we're talking about obviously fiscal capacity as well as governance, by making the framework for dealing with it, the institutional architecture for dealing with it at the EU level necessarily, so involves the non-Euro members, including, very consequentially I think here, including Poland and Hungary. There wasn't any way in keeping those issues out. So I think Orban's pretty much made it clear that he is going to basically try to veto any recovery fund unless essentially that the Article 7 proceedings against Hungary are dropped and he wants out of the agreement, the proposal that's in there at the moment, for some link of conditionality of access to the fund to rule of law issues. So although I think that Matt and I agree about the EU star being muddled through, actually more muddle has been added to the muddle by the way in which the recovery fund proposal was made.
Absolutely. I mean, I would just add to that, it seems like if anything, that these populist regimes in Central and Eastern Europe have more wind in their sails now than they have had in recent memory. One reason is that their economies haven't been as hard hit by the pandemic as, say, the Southern European economies. If you look at Poland in particular, it's doing fine given, everything else that's happening in the EU at the moment. That might be one reason that, you know, that Duda managed to win at the end of the day, but the people aren't, you know, necessarily feeling the economic pressures that, you know, in the same way that they are in other parts of Europe. And now Orban can use this as leverage to say, well, if you want to send this money down to Italy and Spain, you need to get off my back here. And I think that they will, because they know that at the end of the day, they won't be able to do anything anyway. Even if the Article 7 procedure, this infringement procedure against Hungary, were to go forward, ultimately Poland would step in and prevent any real action in any case. So it's all very kind of symbolic in nature. And, you know, I just don't see that changing in the near term. Also, because for the Central and Eastern European countries, you know, this is really about sovereignty for, you know, many of these people in a way that it's not in Western Europe, I would say. That, you know, because they fairly recently only achieved their independence, you know, they are not as willing to have the EU come in and get mixed up in what they view as their domestic affairs. And I just don't see that dynamic changing anytime soon.
I think the other aspect of it is that the Eastern European member state questions also pretty much, or most of the time anyway, necessarily always, serves as a proxy for disagreement between France and Germany about other things. And that, you know, that one of the consequences of the EU's enlargement has essentially been to move, you know, influence and power within the European Union away from France, away from the French-German axis, and further eastwards. So it makes that the German-Poland relationship at least as important to the EU as the French-German relationship. And so, you know, Macron's been somebody who's very keen on the rule of law issues. I think he doesn't like the idea that in terms of his bigger geopolitical visions and what he thinks of as the assertion of European sovereignty, that the East European states get in the way of that. They get in the way of that because, from his point of view, because they want the EU to stay close to the US and to NATO, and that isn't necessarily the way that he thinks about matters. So I think that if you look at the way in which any German government, but certainly Merkel's government, has responded to that, has been to, you know, like push him back down on anything that suggests that he doesn't take the security concerns of the East European member states seriously. And once you do that, you're not going to be in the business, as Matt says, of saying we're going to get really tough with Hungary or Poland about which populace or not is in power in Warsaw or Budapest.
I'd like to ask you one more question on that, Helen, before we move on. And that is, should we be surprised that these countries have gone down this path, really? You know, is this related to their own, it seems to be implicit in what you and Matt are saying, it's a part of their post-Soviet path as emerging states and emerging sovereign states. Should some Western liberals be as shocked as they are that Hungary and Poland have ended up going down this path? And was the period of more liberal, Western liberal style democracy after the Cold War actually the more unusual phenomenon in these countries?
That's a very hard question in some ways to answer. But I would say this, and I think it is often underestimated and forgotten in Western parts of Europe, is that if you look at Orban's return to power in 2010, it was in the context of an acute, really acute financial crisis in Hungary. Poland didn't experience the 2008 crash in the same way in which Hungary did. And, you know, to all intents and purposes, the EU, the Eurozone, hung Hungary out to dry, so to speak. The ECB didn't provide any meaningful help to Hungary, even though at that time, Hungary was on a supposed path to, you know, Euro membership. You know, essentially, that the Federal Reserve Board provided more help to Northern European banks via the European Central Bank than the European Central Bank did to Hungary, even though quite a lot of Hungary's debt was in euros. And I think that is an important context in which Orban and Fidesz have had the political strength that they have had in Hungary over the last decade. So if you add that, a sense of nationalist reaction to what seemed, you know, the indifference of the Eurozone to Hungary's crash experience, to the fact that states that had, as part of, you know, living memory, asserted their nationhoods against the Soviet Empire and in some sense, you know, liberated themselves from Soviet rule. The idea that they were just going to give up on that language of nationhood and just sort of say, okay, nationalisms and nationhood are bad things, they belong in the past, as if somehow that they were the ones who were the imperialists. It was just never going to wash in, it was just never going to wash in Poland and Hungary. Their experience is just historically different in the 20th century than what West European states is. And it's particularly different, obviously, in the second half of the 20th century. So I don't actually think we should be surprised about what's happened, either from the post-crash perspective or from the longer historical perspective.
Moving on from the Visegrad states and coming back towards Western Europe, is there also a sense that with President Macron on the back foot in France, and also the struggles that Italy is facing at the moment, struggles which have made Italy perhaps more Eurosceptic in the last few months, is this kind of national populist style government also going to gain momentum in Western Europe after the coronavirus crisis?
I think not, actually. I think what we're seeing as a result of the crisis is that in many countries, people are understanding that you actually need competent governments in place to deal with issues like this. I think you did see some Euroscepticism, as you say, in Italy in the initial phases of this. But that was there before, to be honest, right? I mean, you have a pretty potent populist movement there, which is very anti-EU in its essence. And you know, the EU's failure in the early stages of this to really, you know, show that it was on top of things and helping in a meaningful way obviously fueled that. I think, though, that it had another effect, though, that it showed that countries alone are also unable to deal with a crisis like this effectively. And it also showed that countries that, you know, some European countries have relied on for quite a long time in times of crisis, in particular the United States and to some degree the UK, can also not be relied on. So I think for much of Europe, even countries like Italy, or maybe even especially countries like Italy, they're saying, well, we might not like the EU really that much, but at the end of the day, we don't have many other options. And so, that, you know, that's why I don't see that this in the long term will really help the populists, because they don't offer any viable alternative. You know, they talk about, you know, partnership with Russia or closer ties to China. And I don't think that's something that, you know, most people in Europe would really look forward to. So I think it might be cathartic in a way in sort of disabusing at least some people of the notion that the populists have all the answers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Italy is the crucial question here, and that prior to the crisis, the five-star league coalition had broken, and so that five-star had been in some sense broken away from its populist partner and was in coalition with the Democrats. And I think in the first months after that government took power, then you could see that actually, although that Salvini had rather miscalculated about what the consequences of breaking the coalition up would be, that actually when the next Italian election came around, that the Liga would be actually be in a strengthened political position. I'm not sure that that's such the case now. I think actually Salvini's had a bad crisis, and Conte, the Italian Prime Minister, has actually done quite well. Obviously, it's true that all the structural causes of the rise of these parties in Italy around the Eurozone is still there. But has the crisis itself strengthened the populists in Italy? I think the answer is no. Will the continuing fallout of the Eurozone's difficulties and the particular burdens that it places on Italy in the future re-strengthen Salvini's position? I think that is quite possible.
And one of the things we've seen recently with the local French elections is that big cities have gone towards the environmental left. And so do you think that this could be a moment for that kind of politics as well after the crisis?
Yes, most definitely. And I think you see that in many European countries. You also saw it before the crisis already, because there was a lot of focus on the effects of climate change, especially as people were really beginning to feel it last summer. This summer, at least where I am in Berlin, has been less dramatic. So it seems that there's less focus on those issues. Nonetheless, they're clearly not going anywhere. And it helps the Greens, I think, in every European Union country, especially if you look at the development in France in the local elections, where the Greens did quite well. And again, you know, here was a situation where, you know, many people thought this might be a big moment for Marine Le Pen and the far right in France, the Rassemblement National. and it turned out not to be the case. I mean, they did fine, but it wasn't sort of, you know, the blowout that they had hoped for. So, you know, even though Emmanuel Macron did not do well either, it wasn't necessarily that you know, people who opposed his views flocked to the far right in the way, you know, you might have expected in the past. So this also seems to be a significant shift, especially, as you say, in urban areas. And that's even true, I think, in some parts of Central and Eastern Europe as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that's been, you know, going on for some time now is that predominantly in Western Europe, the traditional centre-left party has been weakening and the Green parties have been rising. And I mean, Germany's the clearest instance of that, where for quite some time now, you know, the Greens have been polling significantly higher than the Social Democrats. And I think that you would expect what happened in France in these elections, regardless actually of the corona crisis, because essentially what the effect of Macron in the end was to smash the French party system and to leave a vacuum. In some sense, he left a vacuum both on the centre-right initially and on the centre-left. But as his presidency has moved further to the right, I would say, during the course of it, then you say, okay, there was a big space waiting to be filled, that the socialist, you know, like party in France is in a much worse state than the Social Democrats in Germany. So who would you expect to fill it? You would expect the Greens to fill it. And that is what they have done. And there's no doubt that certain aspects of the pandemic crisis, you know, including the fact that particularly in the first months of the crisis, that people across the world, not just in Europe, you know, who live in cities, had in some sense a much better experience of quality of life where the environment's concerned than anything that they'd known for in their lifetimes, was going to have, I think, some impact. But I do think that the deeper structural cause is the one that's at work there in France, is that something had to emerge politically on the centre-left, and you would have bet in the end it was going to be the Greens.
Let's turn now from domestic politics and move towards geopolitics, because all these issues of statecraft and ideological polarization we've been talking about spill over into how Europe interacts with the wider world. And President Ursula von der Leyen came into her role as Commission President in December, promising to lead a geopolitical commission and reassess relations with a reassertive China. How successful has the new commission been at this?
Well, I think not particularly, but I don't think that that's anything really to do with the commission as such. I think it's to do with the general problems that geopolitical questions create for the European Union. And that is both a function of the fact that things are geopolitically pretty difficult for Europe. And that would be true in some sense, regardless of what the European Union was like when it came to geopolitical decision making. And it's true because the European Union isn't well institutionally equipped, and in some sense, it's not well equipped, I think, in mindset either, to deal with geopolitical questions. Because if you go back to the creation of the European Economic Community and the way that that then worked as it became the European Community and into the European Union in the 1990s, is that essentially geopolitical questions were delegated into the security sphere, which meant that NATO dealt with them. So that the EU is geopolitically dependent upon NATO. It primarily formed itself in relation to economic questions. And it's not been able, despite the considerable attempts at different times it's made since the Maastricht Treaty, to find ways, either I would say, of having political structures that work for dealing with geopolitical questions, all getting around the really fundamental disagreements that there are in geopolitically within Europe. And they, in part, were always there. They existed between Germany and France, and when Britain was in the European Union, with Britain into that dynamic too. But they're also there in a whole new light once enlargement to Eastern Europe had taken place, because clearly the Eastern European states are not in the same geopolitical space as the West European states. They've got, as I said earlier, a different historical experience, and their entry had such profound implications, I think, for the Franco-German alliance that made it even more difficult than it already was for those two states to find common ground about geopolitical questions.
So, Helen, how will different capitals be negotiating and navigating relations with Moscow and the Kremlin, for example?
Well, I think that this is where it really gets to the heart of things that were happening late last year in terms of what Macron was articulating about his geopolitical agenda and the pushback that he was getting from Berlin. I think there was one point when Merkel gave him, at least as it was reported, a pretty big ticking off about how he was just essentially an agent of disruption and she had to keep clearing up the mess that he was making. And if you say, well, what is at the centre of that disagreement, it is that Macron thinks that in a geopolitical world that is dominated by the United States and a rising China, that Europe risks vanishing and that there has to be European sovereignty rather than getting swallowed up by one side or another. And for Macron, that means a reset with Moscow, that it's not possible to assert European sovereignty without stopping spending time, in some sense, fighting with Russia about a whole set of other issues. It requires cooperation with Russia. And Merkel's position is that whilst in principle that might be fine, but it might have a case that it ignores certain realities about what's happening in Ukraine. It ignores the position of the East European states and that there can't be a reset with Moscow until that there's a change of behaviour and a change of attitude from Moscow. And that is just, I think, a profound Franco-German disagreement.
So Macron is very high profile, obviously, and he likes to make grand statements and he likes to think of himself as a bit of a maverick, perhaps, on the geopolitical arena. But Matt, you've been writing a lot about Angela Merkel lately and her attempt perhaps to find a middle way between Moscow, Beijing and the West as a kind of honest broker. Do you think this is a shrewd strategy or is there some political naivety going on here?
Well, I don't know that it's naive. I think, as I've said before, that you know history will tell us whether this strategy was genius or reckless in the way Germany is approaching not just China but also Russia. And I increasingly get the impression that Germany wants to position itself. Some people have compared it to Switzerland, that Germany wants to be a big Switzerland. I would say that it really wants to be a big Austria, which is also nominally a neutral country, but quite willing to cut deals with people here and there and do things that might not be totally consistent with the moral standards that the West claims to represent. And the interesting thing about the relationship with Putin and Russia, for example, is as Helen pointed out, Macron has called for this reset, and the Germans have said, we don't want a reset. But at the same time, they're willing to go ahead with this pipeline deal, the so-called Nord Stream 2 deal, which is going to ship Russian gas to Germany and points beyond, allowing Russia, in the view of many people, to circumvent Ukraine and costing Ukraine a lot of revenue in the long term. So they are often, the Germans, playing both sides of these issues. And the same is true of China. I had an interview this week with the German economy minister, Peter Altmaier, who's a confidant of Merkel's, her former chief of staff, and he made very clear that they're in no mood to really condemn China for what has gone on in Hong Kong in relation to the suspension of liberties there with the new security law. And he went so far as to say, well, it would be irresponsible for us to put this relationship at risk because there's so many German jobs and so much German prosperity is linked to our trade relationship with China. So I think it's interesting to see that the German position has maybe evolved a little bit as Berlin's relationship with the US in particular has worsened in recent years. And it's trying much more, I think, to play the middle, to not be too critical, to try and keep everyone happy to the degree that they can.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, it is quite striking that the German position on China has been as cautious where criticism is concerned as it has been. And I think that has actually some quite important implications going forward for the relations between Britain, the UK and the EU over foreign policy. On the whole, I mean, I think there's the odd caveat that needs to be said against this, but on the whole, when it comes to Iran, which was, if you like, the big outstanding geopolitical tension prior to the COVID crisis at the beginning of the year, after Soleimani's assassination, and indeed is going to be quite important over the next months because the UN arms embargo is expiring, that Britain has actually stayed pretty close to the EU's position and hasn't sided with Trump and in the US. Now, if you, though, take the China issue as a point of comparison, even over the last months, and the Hong Kong issue has crystallised it, but I don't think it's just about Hong Kong, is that the British government has actually engaged in a really significant U-turn, I think, on China policy, away from the EU position and towards the US position. And I think that this has been a really consequential development during the last 3 months, whilst we've all, to some extent, all been paying attention to other things.
And finally, there's the situation in the Middle East, and the Syrian crisis is ongoing. There's been disruption in Lebanon with rampant inflation. Libya is still caught in a civil war. Are we going to see a kind of resurgence of the migrant crisis in the coming years? And how well do you think the European Union will be able to deal with it this time?
Well, I think there probably will be a resurgence in terms of the number of refugees fleeing the region. Whether they will end up in Europe or not is another question, because I think the Europeans have become quite good at managing the situation by paying off Turkey in particular to keep the refugees. And it really is a financial question. How much are they willing to pay? And, you know, as is the case with most crises, the second time something happens, you're better prepared for it. And they have a model now. It's a little bit, you know, like what we're seeing with the coronavirus. You know, now that you know what to expect, it's easier to deal with. It remains such a toxic political issue in Europe that I don't see, you know, the willingness of the EU at large to take in large numbers of refugees changing, especially with all of the economic headwinds countries are going to be facing. So I think that they will, you know, turn to this model of basically paying off other countries to deal with the problem. And I think, though, that this issue also comes back to this question that you asked before about, you know, the geopolitical strategy of the Commission and whether it has one. And I think that it doesn't really, because there isn't agreement within the EU itself, and particularly the larger member states are not willing to cede control over these issues to Brussels. And Ursula von der Leyen at the moment certainly just does not have the stature to take responsibility for these issues. And everybody knows that it really is Merkel and Macron who are the kind of leading forces on this front. And I sometimes think, you know, maybe it would be better for the Commission not to even, you know, try to do this, because they kind of set themselves up to fail always. And I think in this region, again, you know, that's certainly been the recent history.
Yeah, I agree on the migrant crisis. I think that the crucial question, though, is the relationship with Turkey as it is at the moment that allows basically a financial payoff sustainable or not? And I think that if you look at the last month's relations with Turkey, particularly French relations with Turkey, have become quite a lot more fraught, in significant part because of the situation in Libya. Macron's rhetoric on the subject of Turkey, which was already getting quite strong, shall we say, at the end of last year, when he, you know, it was in the context of Turkey that he talked about, Turkey and Syria, that he talked about NATO's brain death, has become even stronger, I think, during the last months because of what's gone on in Libya and what's going on in the Eastern Mediterranean. So I would say is that the EU's preferred tactic for dealing with the likely future migrant crisis will be the same as it was from March 2016. But it actually might be more difficult to bring that about because of the fact that the relationship with Turkey is quite hard to stabilise. And indeed, that critiquing it is part of Macron's geopolitical ambitions.
I think that's a really interesting point. But if you look back over the last few years at the relationship, I mean, it has been fraught. And there were also pretty dramatic tensions with Turkey over the decision to buy Russian missile batteries and so forth, to the degree that you had NATO allies pulling people out of the Incirlik air base, which is a major air base in Turkey used by Germany and the US and others. And yet they still managed to forge a deal over the refugees, I think for the simple reason that Erdogan needs the money. And, you know, he's willing to quietly cut these deals. And he's been quite relentless, I think, in showing the degree to which he can open the spigots, as it were, and, you know, by sending people over the Greek border as a kind of warning to Europe that if it doesn't sort of dance to his tune, that he's going to open the floodgate.
So finally, Helen, in light of everything we've discussed today, do you think a stronger Europe will emerge from the crisis?
No. I mean, I think that I would go back to what Matt and I were saying or arguing earlier, which is that default mode is to muddle through. And I think that that hasn't changed. I would say, though, that the two things that have happened that are going to make things significantly more difficult than I think that they were in terms of how that muddle works out is the politicization of the single market under conditions in which important aspects of it were suspended. And it is going, to go back to a point that Matt made earlier, to show once again Germany's central position within the European Union. That is a reality that can keep trying to be suppressed in some sense, but it keeps coming out, and it is over the single market found a new way to manifest itself. Or to manifest itself very visibly, let's put it that way. And the second thing is that I do think that in using the EU budget, the multi-annual framework, to deal with the Eurozone recovery fund, that has actually compounded the structural muddle for the Eurozone and made it more difficult to muddle through. That doesn't mean there won't be found some way of muddling through. It's just that in some sense, the contradictions have now been doubled down on in terms of that tension between having a European Union and having a single currency within it, whilst other member states retain their own currencies.
Matt and Helen, thank you very much. That's all we have time for today. Next episode, I'll be joined by Benedict Evans, who will be talking about the future of technology.